This episode is presented by Henry's Wine and Spirit.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good evening, and welcome to the start of a brand new season of Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liut, and we're broadcasting live from Bushwick on Heritage Radio Network. So, as some of you may be able to tell from my episodes, if I had to define my general outlook on life, I would say that I'm cautiously optimistic, with a heavy emphasis on cautious. And certainly today, in a world where I wonder what fresh hell I will read about in the newspaper every morning, I am running much more pessimistic. But it's the start of a new year, filled with new opportunities and possibilities. So I am choosing to be more hopeful about our collective future. To that end, author Gary Napan is joining the show today to talk about his new book, Food from the Radical Center, Healing Our Communities and Our Land, which presents a collection of stories that illustrate what good can happen when people organize and work together to restore land in order to produce healthy foods. Gary is an agricultural ecologist, ethnobotanist, interfaith Franciscan brother, and author whose work has primarily focused on the interaction of biodiversity and cultural diversity of the arid binational Southwest. He's considered a pioneer in the local food movement and in the heirloom seed-saving movement. Gary, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. Your list of accomplishments and the work that you do is so impressive and impactful and powerful. Like, complicated, I think, that I can't even pronounce the words.
Like, well,
might need to try that again.
Let's just say that I collaborate with a lot of people across disciplines and across cultures. So if some of those words have multiple adjectives on them, it's because I'm trying to walk across the boundaries.
All right. Well, you know, in fact, to that end, your work has, you have been described as a biocultural conservationist, which is a term that is apparently way easier for me to say. Can you define what this means and how you got into this field?
Well, thank you. The word implies that we can't really save nature without stabilizing, celebrating, and safeguarding our cultural values and our connections between cultures and nature. So if we lock people out of interactions with nature, including healthy farmlands, we're not doing much good in the long run because we need cultural communities over generations to maintain those connections. And I got into this through working at the first Earth Day headquarters in 1970 at that first event that brought 20 million people together around the world to celebrate our natural world and to sort of up the ante to protect it, just like many of the marches on Washington and the climate accords are doing today. Mm-hmm. So as a 17-year-old, I was already engaged in thinking about these issues of environmental justice and food justice.
Okay, so before we kind of get into the more optimistic parts of the book, I want to lay the groundwork for where we are today. And you offered some really interesting statistics on just how divided we are as a country. So let's first kind of start with that and then move into the effects it has on the environment. But you said something that, you know, that I at least feel, especially when I travel outside New York, which is, you know, we're more divided than ever along political lines. You write that in 2016 national election, in the national election, 80% of the country had landslide victories, where one dominant party ran a full slate of like-minded individuals. Can you tell us a little bit more about this divide?
Right. I mean, we've always been a heterogeneous country, and yet now the divides between different ideologies, political parties, faith, urban, rural, et cetera, are deeper than ever. So more people vote in a way that the other side might consider extreme rather than finding more people that are interested in walking across the aisle into the middle. And we see that in the kind of stalemate between different parts of our government today. That's no news to any of us in America. Mm-hmm. But I think how severe this has become in the last 20 years, including a sense that you're either for jobs or for the environment, a kind of false dualism in my mind, has never been stronger. I mean, even when we've had Republican presidents like Richard Nixon, we were preserving lands and we were helping farmers and all of that. So it seems to me that the trouble we have now is not that people have different points of view. I welcome that. But they're really entrenched and they're not hearing people. And in fact, they're disparaging people who have a different point of view than their own.
And you think this is true, even though we've always had a two-party system, by and large, in this country?
That's right. The statisticians and the pollsters really say this is deeper than ever. So looking at a Grand Canyon-sized chasm mm-hmm. between different parts of America now, and it's indigenous and immigrant. It's urban and rural. It's not just Democrat and Republican. And that's why I don't think Washington can take care of this problem for us. We have to walk toward the radical center or the middle path together and listen to people whose views are unlike our own. And the key, I think, is working together on the ground, and some of that ideological posturing fades away when we're actually participating in community-based projects.
Yeah, and one thing that you said that I kind of want to highlight is that the first Earth Day in 1970 did happen under Richard Nixon, and you write that that he said that environmental responsibility can unite Americans, who, it's funny because at that point there was a big divide in the country, right, between like the war and race and whatnot. So it seems like we've kind of returned. This issue has become very partisan with one. Yeah. Right. I mean, like with one side thinking that it's a priority to address environmental issues and the other like denying the existence that there is an issue.
That's right. And so we had great Republican conservationists from Teddy Roosevelt through Nixon, who at one time had set aside more national park lands than any other president. But more than that, you've said something very, very important there, that the first Earth Day did bring people out who weren't just scientists or doomsdayers. Faiths were involved. I talked on Earth Day at a Catholic college in Iowa, and the nuns were very funny. They said, "I think you're okay as long as you just don't bring up abortion today."
Well, but that, yeah.
but it was, what I'm saying is they saw common ground.
Right.
The people that I worked with in the office in Washington, D.C., came from the civil rights movement, from a civil rights summer and the anti-Vietnam War movement. And yet they said, what we really want to do now is bring people together and deal with our urban environmental injustices. I wrote on lead poisoning in cities while I was there and issues like that.
Still so happening today.
Yeah, that's
still
right.
Still a really big problem.
It wasn't just about wilderness.
Right.
You're absolutely right that it's still happening today. But that was the first calling attention to the issues in a way that said, these are problems that we must be united about to solve.
Right. I guess, I mean, and this is kind of getting a bit off topic, but we are a country that seems more and more are like a one issue, like issues are kind of like, or voters are sort of like one issue. That's how they decide to vote, right? So they're like, this candidate is pro-life, and so that's the most important thing to me, and that's what I'm voting on. So, like, how do you work across the aisle if you just ultimately don't prioritize? You know, how do you, who do you vote for if you don't prioritize the environment exclusively?
That's right, and it's not just about voting. We're siloed in so many other ways. Each of us can just listen to one station, whether it's, you know, Fox News or MSNBC, and never hear another point of view if we don't really seek those out. And so it's not just that we're a one-issue thing. I'm voting for this person only because I lost tons of money during the recession, and I don't care if it looks like greed. I want regulations out of the way so I can make more money again.
Mm-hmm.
There's people who are saying that who aren't mean-spirited people, but they're saying, I lost all my life savings in the last 10 years. I got to see the economy working again. And I think the people in the Rust Belt, say, that are lower middle class who've lost their jobs, the rest of us need to understand why they're voting the way they do and have empathy for the root, how they're dealing with that, and look for the root causes of it. And I would say the only difference I have with some of those people is in assigning blame. Who caused the problem? I think it's much more some structural issues, not one party or the other. And so we may have differences in who we want to blame for a problem, but I have empathy for the people who've lost their jobs over the last 10 years, don't want to see jobs go overseas, are worried about immigrants coming into the country, taking their jobs. I don't think that's a substantive argument in terms of those people really taking jobs away from native-born Americans. But what I'm saying is underlying empathy for people who have differences of opinion, who've suffered, is still important.
Right. And deprioritized. Or somehow I think that concept is lost even more so than ever.
Oh, I agree with you. I completely agree with your context here.
So, okay. So you do say, though, that that Americans are not really divided. This I felt like there were some things in the book that kind of confused me. And one of
let's talk about that.
Yeah. You wrote that that we're not divided over whether or not the environment needs restoration or that communities require social healing. But it does seem that, like, in some of the decisions that have either come out of the administration or like the kind of unbridled hatred that we see between community groups, like, I don't actually see how there isn't division among Americans amongst how important this is to address.
Well, there are certainly the divisions. What I'm saying, I'll give you two examples, is that most people really care about the environment in which they live, the water, the air, even the noise pollution. They want their kids to live healthy lives and understand that certain kinds of contamination imperil that. They like seeing wildlife. They're thrilled by it, mm-hmm. whether they're hunters or whether they're vegans that use binoculars to birdwatch. But they disagree on whether conserving and restoring a healthy environment and a diverse food system should be done by regulation and punitive actions against bad players, or whether it should be done by incentives and moving some of the decision-making to the community level. They don't feel heard about the environmental concerns that they're most worried about, that they care about. So they know that some lands need protected in their neighborhood or in their county, but they don't want that a top-down decision-making because they think they have what we call ecological knowledge. With Native Americans I work with, we mm-hmm. call it indigenous knowledge or traditional ecological knowledge, and they don't feel that that's being heard by who they call bureaucrats, what some people call the expertocracy. They want to be engaged in the decision making, and they feel that they've been disempowered. And that's Native Americans I know, immigrants I know. A lot of people feel that way, but it's not that they don't care about the environment or a healthy food system.
Okay, so just to kind of push back on the idea that they want to be more involved, another thing that you talk about was that, you talk a lot about community-based collaboration, and that's the need, what we need to do, and we need to come towards the Radical Center. Can you actually first tell us what that is, what that term means?
Yeah, the rancher Bill McDonald, who started with four or five other people, the Malpai Borderlands Group, collaboration between ranchers, place-based environmentalists, and state and federal agencies in our region, in the U.S. Southwest, applied that term to the need to walk toward the middle and saying, that's actually a more radical, audacious place to be now, of actually listening to other people, mm-hmm. of finding common ground, than people who call themselves radical environmentalists who just won't listen to anyone else, or sagebrush rebellion, anti-conservation people who are really playing an old trope. The more radical thing right now, and it's hard for even environmentalists to do, is say we need to build bigger coalitions with people who don't dress like us, speak like us, pray like us, but have valuable things to say about where they live and should be included in the decision making.
Okay. And so that's the center. That's where you want to get people to come towards.
That's right. And a collaboration between organic farmers and conventional farmers on the West Coast calls that same space the middle path.
Okay. Okay, great. So you know what? Let's actually transition. I'm going to save my question for later, but let's transition to the meat of your book, which really gave a lot of hopeful examples about community-based collaboration that has really been successful in healing, as the title of your book states, like the communities and the land. So you talk about several environmental issues, from water scarcity to nutrient depletion in our soil. So I want to go through a few of these and just kind of provide a little bit more background. So let's start with water scarcity. What's the problem here? First, can you lay out kind of like the issue with where we are right now?
Well, that's great. In the West, in particular, because of drought and wildfires and urbanization of certain plains and watersheds, we've really seen a number of our rivers dewatered. And I live between the longest and most well-known rivers that once flowed all the way to the ocean and don't 300 days of the year or more every year. And that's the Rio Grande that comes down from Colorado and New Mexico to Texas, and the Colorado River that comes down from Colorado, Utah to Arizona and California and into Mexico. And you can't blame the dewatering of those rivers on one issue. But to solve the problem, you really need hundreds of local, state, and federal organizations, both grassroots organizations and federal agencies, in the room together. And so in the case of the Colorado River, whose watershed I live in, I remember going 20 years ago when I was kind of an earth firster, radical environmentalist, and I heard a guy say, it's going to take 50 agencies at the irrigation district, local, county, state, and federal level of coming together, or we're not going to see water on the Colorado River Delta that then feeds the Gulf of California, where most of the West gets its fish, not from the Pacific Ocean. And we need people to collaborate to get that done. Now, let's start that process. And I thought, pie in the sky. This will never work. And within 5 years, we saw people restoring wetlands on the floodplain, farmers letting back some of their irrigation allotment to rewater part of the Colorado River Delta, and a lot of other voluntary actions, both by irrigation districts and their farmers, and by federal agencies, to flip that around after a century of going in the wrong way. So the policy radically changed, and U.S.-Mexico collaboration was part of it, but it was also getting over the us versus them dialectic between California and Arizona, or the upper basin of the Colorado and the lower basin. So people had been siloed, were thinking about only themselves, and the wildlife and actually the economy were suffering because of that.
And what was the, you know, kind of like up, like you talk in particular, you highlight one particular project that had like a lot of success. Can you tell us more about that?
I have a wonderful neighbor, Valerie Austin, who's put in 22,000 check dams in a collaboration with Mexican stonemasons, artisans on who come from south of the border but have helped her do this on both sides of the border in a watershed that actually flows from Arizona into Mexico. And miles of river that hadn't flowed for years are now reflowing. The wildlife has come back. Tens of thousands of tons of soil that would otherwise wash out to the ocean are now being held in place behind these 22,000 check dams that she did. It's created jobs. It's created wildlife hunting opportunities that then bring more money into the local economy. And it's been a win-win situation for ranchers and environmentalists. And so if you have water staying in place, the rangelands recuperate almost on their own. If you keep all that water from being one big flash flood, but instead let it slowly seep into the ground and seep into the watershed, you're replenishing the groundwater and you're renewing the surface water that wildlife and recreationists need. So that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. It always takes more than one person or one skill set to do that. It's literally the best example of it takes a village that I know of. In this case, it was a binational village. So here we're talking about a wall, and yet people on both sides of the border are collaborating to bring back a binational watershed. And that's what we're doing with a nonprofit where I live in Patagonia, Arizona, Borderlands Restoration Network, that has employed 136 high school kids to help with this and created about 70 new jobs in our rural community where unemployment was over 25-30% at the time of the 2008 recession. So that restoration economy is now the third largest, if you want to call it, industry in the rural West.
Wow, that's incredible. And definitely a cause for optimism. I think, and this is not something that I know too much about, but didn't Beto O'Rourke write an article or talk about the seriously negative consequences that this wall with Mexico will have on wildlife and like from an ecological perspective? Did you read that?
I did, and a good friend of mine who was at once the highest ranking ecologist in the Clinton administration, Ron Pulliam, and I also wrote an article that was in about 40 Western newspapers. And 10,000 scientists collectively wrote a petition and that was attached to an article called Scientists United from Both Sides of the Border, Wildlife Divided, a large portion of all the endangered species on one side of the border or another will be negatively impacted by the wall, not simply because they can't walk across, but it fragments the gene pools, and rare species, if they have inbreeding, are even more vulnerable to extinction. So there's multiple reasons that a 60-foot wall or even a 30-foot wall will impact a large variety of wildlife and even plants that I've studied, like night-blooming cacti.
Well, that's just great.
Yeah, but what, you know, your cautious optimism and your healthy skepticism are both warranted. I mean, when you opened that, I said, you know, I'm with you. I'm sort of like a cerebral pessimist, but a glandular optimist. You know, I mean, if something can get me up in the morning in a positive way, I'm going to stick with it, even though there's obviously many dark signs around us right now.
Right.
And I think that despite the fact that we have this debate over the border, that 10,000 scientists came together to say, we have to work together or all our efforts are down the tube, shows that whatever you want to call it, the resistance or the counterpoint is more important now than ever before. So it's an ill wind that blows no good, I guess, is the moral to the story here.
Yeah. Okay, well, what about, so another chapter you have devoted to pollinators and the steep decline in the populations of bees, butterflies, bats, doves, et cetera. So can you tell us a little bit about this particular issue and an example of how you collaborated to make an impact?
Well, thank you. That's an issue that I've worked on for 20 years or more. In 1995, I wrote a book with a world-class bee ecologist, Stephen Buckman, called The Forgotten Pollinators, which was sort of the first, Paul Revere's warning cry that we had to do something about declining pollinators, not just honeybees, which get most of the press, but bats, butterflies, hummingbirds, native bees, and all of that. And we came up with a statistic that's now in a dozen movies and 100 books and over 800 scientific papers that one out of every three bites of food that we eat is brought to us by a pollinator. There had not been a nationally released and distributed book since Rachel Carson's Silent Spring that drew as much attention to pollinators. And yet, it wasn't just something that Steve and I did together. We formed a network of farmers, bat conservationists, nurserymen, beekeepers, people of many professions to guide a Forgotten Pollinators campaign. Within 2 years of the book coming out, we must have visited 36 states for that book, barnstorming, and being on radio shows like this in at least a dozen states. We saw things like state pollinator protection plans being written, National Academy of Sciences, National Research Council overview on this, the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Department of Interior bringing scientists within their two agencies together for the first time to deal with this issue in a cohesive way rather than being fragmented. And 4 years ago, I had the pleasure of being at the first ever White House summit on pollinators. And that seemed like just an amazing thing. Industry was involved, Burt's Bees and many other companies that said, we wouldn't have a staff, any income were it not for pollinators. So there's been a groundswell of attention to this. And again, more recently with a grassroots group called Make Way for Monarchs, we worked with the Mexican poet laureate Homer R. Regis and many great monarch butterfly scientists to get a front page story in the New York Times and 250 scientists from eight countries to say to the three Mexican presidents, we need a monarch butterfly tri-national plan. Mm-hmm. And a hand letter, hand-delivered letter was taken to the three presidents when they met in Mexico, and they agreed to go ahead with a plan, and it's moving along, and over 70,000 farmers
wow.
have been trained in pollinator protection and planting wildflowers and other plants to bring back pollinators just in the last 5 years.
That is awesome. That is really great to hear. We're going to have to take a super quick commercial break in just 1 minute, but one question I want to ask or kind of point I want to highlight relating to this topic specifically is, and you touched on it, you said that there, you know, the involvement of the ag industry was something that kind of helped you, it shifted your view of the industry. And, you know, this is something certainly that I have found in my work. I think there's been a tendency, like a big divide between the advocacy community and industry. And there's an idea that you kind of can't work together. I mean, certainly from the advocacy side, to kind of dismiss some of the good things that industry could be working on. So how has your view of this kind of like divide shifted and the possibility that the ag industry can make an impact?
Well, in short, I would say that I quickly learned that instead of poking someone in the eye and calling them an adversary, to knock on their door and say, there's a big challenge in front of us and we need you, is so important. And as one guy at this pollinator summit at the White House said, we need everyone on deck. We need all hands on deck. We can't solve this problem without the ag industry. Mm-hmm. They have farmers networks that if the farmers don't hear about this or think that people are attacking the industry rather than wanting their participation, not only will environmentalists lose, the monarch butterflies and the bees will lose. And so I've been humbled by both the heterogeneity of in the industrial ag community. They're not all bad guys. They don't need disparage. We need big ag to become more sustainable. And instead of stiffing them, we need to engage in them and see where there's common ground.
Is this an example of you also say that one of the things you've learned is that, you know, kind of after certain failures in an agenda, your agenda, environmentalists have to kind of seek a new way to reframe their concerns in a way that's more compatible with another person's values. Is this an example of how you've done that, working with the industry?
That's exactly it. So I have to talk to soybean farmers, ranchers, people that their job is to spray herbicides on weeds, on roadsides or on farms. And to not find a common language and common values is to say, I assume I will fail. And unless we bring them on board and find ways that we use their ingenuity and problem-solving skills, there's a stalemate.
Yeah. Okay, all right. With that, I'm going to take a super quick commercial break and hear a word from our sponsors, but stay tuned.
This episode is presented by Henry's Wine and Spirit, a go-to shop for anyone interested in natural wines and boutique spirits. There's a large selection of everything from orange wines, pet nats, and reds from around the world. Whether visiting the shop in person or online, looking for a gift for a loved one, or that everyday dependable bottle, you're sure to find lots of interesting wines at Henry's. There's free shipping on orders over $300 on the website henrys.nyc and case discounts when you visit the store located in Bushwick. Cheers!
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with author Gary Nabhan on his new book, Food from the Radical Center. All right. So I want to shift to talk about regulation a little bit. This is something that, I mean, there's a big focus on the need for community engagement, obviously, in the book. But the need for regulation is and oversight is something that I'm personally, like pretty, I think is like super important. So can you explain what you think the role of the federal government is in conservation and restoration efforts today?
Well, I like the way you framed this issue, and it's a big one. And I am not 100% against regulation. My life has been saved by regulation in some ways that I won't go into. but let me just say that if we only have one tool in our toolbox, and it's a hammer, we will make every problem into a nail.
Right.
And what I'm saying is that that's what's happened in many of the agencies. Both industry and many local communities fear rather than want to collaborate with the Environmental Protection Agency, although the Environmental Protection Agency has some terrific programs, like a wonderful a border justice program down where I live.
Mm-hmm.
But they're perceived as being only about regulation and punitive damage to people that don't respect the environment. And I think we just need a diversified toolkit to bring more people on board with things. So, for instance, I have two endangered fish on my land in a pond that we have on our land. And I take this very personally because in allowing the Fish and Wildlife Service and Game and Fish to put them in my land, I had to sign a safe harbor agreement saying, into perpetuity, I will not do anything to injure those fish and strive in every way possible, even during catastrophic droughts, to keep that pond full with water. And in fact, I was doing that today. Mm-hmm. I was filling that with water because the other source of water into the pond has been temporarily disrupted, and now it's all on me. So, but I signed a safe harbor agreement with the government that said, as long as I, as a private landowner, am trying to do the right thing, if there's accidental loss of those endangered species, what's called a taking, I'm not liable, but I have to help with the recovery and the regeneration of them even harder. So it's not a punitive structure. It's actually freeing me of liability as long as I'm in the team trying to solve the problem. I think we need more examples like that. And when I talk to Native American medicine men that say, for thousands of years, my clan has used eagle feathers in our ceremonies, and over the last 30 years, we've had trouble getting those even from road-killed birds because of federal laws. A bunch of Native American religious leaders and the Fish and Wildlife Service went to that problem and created a repository for road kills and damaged birds that then Native American religious communities can use. And so rather than this punitive, our relationship with nature is don't touch, there's been shifts in the agencies in response to communities' real needs. And I think when we have options other than just regulation and punitive fines to bring people on board, we have that diversified toolkit that we need. Yeah. Regulation will always be part of that toolkit, but won't be used for every problem.
It's certainly true that from like a psychological perspective, positive reinforcement and negative reinforcement, which isn't punishment, is proven to be way, way, way more effective than anything punitive. So it makes perfect sense that this would apply to.
Well, and you're right about that, and it's even more true when we're talking about long-term ecological restoration of a watershed or a river or a forest. If people aren't involved and a government agency does reforestation or a rewatering of a river, quote, on behalf of the community, you don't have the buy-in from the community. They don't feel as proud about it that someone else did it for them. And sooner or later, it's undermined by pushback from the community. And Franklin Duke's a brilliant professor on community-based collaboration at University of Virginia says, we've analyzed thousands of environmental projects, and if we take that sort of narrow approach that it's better for the government agencies to do this than the communities, the efforts never reach their aspired
potential.
To goals, yeah. and everyone loses out, including the people who manage that project. So for long-term restoration, we need that community participation across generations.
So speaking of community, another thing that you point out is that today we are, as Americans, bowling alone. You use the term. By the way, I love a good Robert Putnam reference.
Oh, I love Robert Putnam.
And for our listeners who haven't read his book, which is titled Bowling Alone, it basically proves that as a country, we've become increasingly disconnected from family, friends, neighbors, our democratic structures. And examples of this is that we're less involved. We sign fewer petitions. We don't belong to as many organizations. We meet friends less frequently, etc. So this is a way for me to ask you, Gary, is how in a time where we need to rely on our community to make meaningful impacts in environmental conservation, how are we going to rely on our communities if we are less engaged than we ever have been historically?
Well, that's right. So many people who call themselves environmentalists, their only engagement is sending a check off to a national organization. And there's no hands-on participation in one sector of the environmental movement. In another sector, it's all about participation. So if you're a guy from Ducks Unlimited or a National Association of Conservation District local team in a county in Kansas, you go out together and you create habitat for wild turkeys or for fish. And that work brings you together with people who may vote different from you, have a different church, be of a different ethnicity, but you all love ducks or you all love salmon or you all love trout.
But how do you encourage people to seek out those opportunities if we're, you know, more disengaged than ever? Like, what's the catalyst?
The catalyst is twofold. I think we start young, and we really win people over by the satisfaction of participation. It's not nature's hands off; it's nature's hands on. So we engage kids real early, and it grows to be part of their, not just their ethic in a cerebral way, but what they love to do on weekends. It's like the nature study movement a century ago, where something like 40 to 60% of the families in the U.S. went out and hiked where wildflowers were abundant and tried to identify them together. And so it becomes part of the activities that you love more than sitting on your iPhone scanning social media. Mm-hmm. I think the second part is that it's that very ancient gesture that's in nearly every faith, not just Christians, that the most profound way you show respect for the diversity and dignity of humanity is coming together at a common table. Mm-hmm. And that when we eat together, just like when we restored land together, those ideologies fall away. Our reticence to hear people different from ourselves slowly falls away. In some cases, very rapidly falls away, because I've seen it. And you just say, oh, I thought that guy was an adversary, or I thought all people of X were only in this country to Y.
Yeah.
And then you hear their story over the table when someone's sitting next to you, and you're actually ashamed or embarrassed or humbled that person has every right to be in your community that you have and that you can learn something from them. So I'm saying that we need we can't talk our way out of this issue. We have to work together on the land, and we need to eat together in a way that changes it from just being a cerebral thing to a sensory, tactile thing.
Yeah. What about for somebody like me? You also state like what? How many more people live in urban communities? Like 80% or something?
Yeah,
like
we're approaching 80% globally, and huge voter blocks and power blocks in urban areas, and a lot of rural people feel disempowered because
right.
of that.
So what about, opportunities for those living in an urban environment to get involved? Is this something that we can participate in, or is it mostly in rural and suburban communities?
No, it's not at all in rural and communities and wilderness areas. I'm keynoting it's almost like a summit more than a conference called Wild Things in Chicago in a few more weeks. And it's mostly urban restorationists that are working with the Chicago area county forests and doing habitat restoration in the urban matrix. People who are bringing back heirloom apples to New York City, people that are doing guerrilla grafting in San Francisco, people that are bringing Gila top minnows, a native fish that was near extinction, back into urban areas for mosquito control. They're doing it for a variety of reasons, but it's fun and it gets people out together, and very often it heals the urban-rural divide, like a group in British Columbia called Farm Folk, City Folk, where it invites the young activists in from rural areas who feel isolated part of the time into the city to see some of these projects and help with the skill sets of grafting or propagating berry bushes or something like that. And then the urban people go out to the farm and help them with healing gullies or planting wildlife habitat. So this is something that my Native American friend Robin Kimmer calls reciprocal restoration. Mm. We're restoring the land, but by working on the land, we're somehow restored in our relationships with one another.
I love that. Where can listeners go, if they want to kind of get involved? Is there an organization that has a lot of these, kind of projects listed?
It's diverse, and it should be. In other words, it's not a top-down restoration movement. We have great national organizations that always have sessions on this, like the Society for Ecological Restoration and the annual Native Seed Conference that is part of a national seed strategy.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a variety of groups in each region. In the Southwest, we have an annual conference in New Mexico led by the Kivira Coalition that has probably involved over 150 grassroots and nonprofit groups, as well as thousands of ranchers and farmers in it. So it varies where you are. MAFCA and the Common Ground Fair in Maine, Moses in the Midwest, that's organic farmers, but it's really talking about the health of rural economies. The Land Institute in Kansas. I could keep on going on,
yeah.
But I think you get the picture.
Right, of these various organizations where people can kind of look for volunteer opportunities to get involved.
That's right. And I have to say that our buddy Putnam says that volunteerism has declined
right.
in the U.S. and that I feel that we need to have every college student do an internship with a nonprofit group or grassroots alliance before they get out of college. We need every senior center to say, you shouldn't be stuck in isolation with people of your own age.
Mm-hmm.
Kids need to hear your life story and learn your skill set. So when we created healing gardens with Native American communities around diabetes clinics where elderly people are on dialysis machines all day, high school kids ask for the help of those elders in planting Native gardens for food production. They're not forgetting about those elders. So it's really intergenerational healing.
What's next for you? A new book? Are you working on a new book or any kind of fun upcoming projects that you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm barnstorming the country with this Food for the Radical Center book up till 2020 on the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. I'm talking to regional conferences and faith-based groups and science-based groups all around the country because I think this is so important. It's not just my life work for the last 40 years. It's to celebrate the many good things that people have done that don't need to be swept under the rug because our news media love the catastrophes and the disasters and the acrimony. Mm-hmm. We need to tell those stories of people coming together now more than ever. So yeah. For the next year and a half, I am in a full court press mode to say there's good news from the North American continent, not just from the U.S., but Canada, Mexico, and rural and urban communities throughout this country, and we need to support those and bring more moral as well as financial support to people who are bringing us together rather than dividing us.
Two final questions. First, where can people go to kind of follow your work and to see where you will be? And second, where can all of our listeners get a copy of this amazing book?
Well, thank you for asking. I have a website that's just my name, GaryNabhan.com, GaryNabhan.com. And it tells the events that I'll be doing for about 6 months out and all the recent op-eds and postings, excerpts or adaptations of this book that are going out to magazines and newspapers across the country, reminding people of examples in their own backyard. I'm willing to do workshops, not just talking head lectures, so that people get the skill sets of how to do this on their own. Many people have these skills, of course. And then the book is available from Island Press, a nonprofit press that has been working tirelessly for a healthy environmental community, not just a healthy environment, but really trying to diversify who is involved in restoration and conservation, and to give them skill sets and values that will take them along over the long haul.
All right. Well, we have to leave it there. But Gary, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your experience and telling us more about your book.
Well, eating matters to us. Now more than ever before, the kinds of dialogues that you have are really helping reshape how we interact with one another. So thank you and your staff for all the good work you do.
Thank you so much. All right. I also want to give a big thanks to our sponsors who support programs like Eating Matters, as well as our fabulous engineer, Matt Patterson. Show music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast wherever they're found. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe and leave me a comment. Let me know what you think. I'm Jenna Liut, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.